Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
We felt good about ourselves. You know, we came down the stretch playing very good baseball, and we did some things in this series that I don't think were characteristic of our team. We made some errors, kicked the ball around a little bit. You know, sometimes you don't swing the bat. That's part of it. But we made it harder to win in some cases, especially the last two games. You know, nobody wanted the season to be over. It doesn't wind down. It comes to a crashing halt. Nobody, myself included, was ready for it to be over. You know, starting out, I thought first inning was came out of the chute good. You know, he didn't locate the first home run to Didi. I just thought quickly his stuff was starting to trend down. You know, even the last inning, he got a strikeout on a hanging breaking ball. Just wasn't the normal crisp, you know, especially the movement. A lot of pitches were flat. You know, whatever you say isn't going to make anybody feel better tonight. We win together and we lost together. It was an honor to go through this year with these guys. And there's times that hurt, like tonight. I don't know if I'm ready to even think about guys moving on. We're 8 minutes from digesting a loss. The game's still a little too raw to go into that yet.
He was a little mad yesterday. He came in sore, you know, wasn't able to practice. But he's going to be day-to-day, and I'm just trying to get him right for the first game. Knowing LeBron, he's definitely not going to want to miss that first game. He's going to do everything in his power to get back out there on the floor. You know, we're just glad we're able to have this many days off in between before our first game.
We had a ball game that, you know, stuff happens. We had fumbles. We had turnovers. We had things that just occurred. We had a shotgun snap to their quarterback. He fumbles it and then picks up a critical first down. I mean, things happen and during the course of the game, you don't necessarily know why they're happening, but they keep happening. And that's where you go back and you learn from it. You look at it, you make corrections, and you move on with the mindset of not letting it happen again. I can understand a quarterback question and, you know, there being a quarterback controversy. We never really discuss a, you know, right tackle or a guard or a center controversy. We look forward to getting back today and doing everything on both sides of the ball and in special teams to contribute to a victory. And we're fortunate to have an opponent to play this week and opportunities ahead of us.
Yeah, I think night games present unique challenges, just like noon games. We have a really good routine that we adjust every year according to our performance. And Coach Mick's in charge of that. And so it is tough. It's to sit around a hotel and all that. But that's, you know, life in the big city. The comments made earlier this week are more about the post. Because we land and I drive home, I get home about 4:30. They're on a bus. They pull in after 5 o'clock in the morning. I can hear the TV people or administrators or conference office people. You know, anybody with common sense would look at that and say, we got to have a conversation about this.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, it is the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Network. My, oh my. My, oh my. I saw one headline among many. You can find every different newspaper and or sports broadcast website or blog, and everybody's going to have their own crazy euphemism and interesting word choice to describe the latest collapse from a two-game lead in a playoff series for the Cleveland Indians. The one that I liked best, a take on the nickname for the World Series. You know what the nickname for the World Series is, Jim. What is the nickname that people often have for the World Series? They call it the what?
Fall Classic.
The Fall Classic. The Indians, of course, just endured the Classic Fall. That was my favorite one. That was my favorite one of all of the ways to describe what just happened. The Classic Fall. For the best team in the American League. The Classic Fall of the team of the 22-game winning streak, the classic fall of a team that surged so much in the second half they nearly overtook the Dodgers for the best record in all of baseball. A classic fall of the team that had a 3-1 series lead in the World Series, poised to break their drought that began or has been ongoing since 1948. A classic fall, despite being up 3-1 with home field advantage. A classic fall of a team that was up 2-0 and also had home field advantage. It indeed was a classic fall that has robbed the Cleveland Indians for another chance at the Fall Classic. And here I am, not quite 24 hours later. Of course, it ended last night at around 11 o'clock, 11:30, whatever it was. And I still can't process it. I still don't understand how a team that had the best run-scoring lineup in the American League in the regular season, a team that had the best bullpen in the American League in the regular season, a team that had the best team ERA for starters and bullpen in all of the majors in the regular season, a team that had the Cy Young Award winner be able to go in games 2 and 5 in this postseason, how it is that MVP candidates like Ramirez and Lindor suddenly can't swing the bat against 72-year-old CC Sabathia, how it is that the team that has the Hall of Fame manager in waiting, Terry Francona, against a team that had a guy that was probably not going to be back with his team after this division series loss, talking about Joe Girardi, how it is that that team can indeed suffer the classic fall, allowing the hated, reviled, despised, disgusting, hideous, horrific New York Yankees to advance to the American League Championship Series. How did it all happen? Nearly 24 hours, and I still haven't figured that out. Kushel and I came on the air yesterday predicting victory, but having all kinds of trepidation. I came on the air yesterday saying that from the head, there's no reason that the Cleveland Indians, who are just top to bottom a better baseball team with a better baseball manager, with a better starter on the mound, there's no reason, using my head and my baseball rationale and ability to analyze, there's no reason at all that the Indians should not be popping champagne corks by the end of last night. My head tells me they're clearly the better team that will win, especially with the aid of home field advantage, but that my heart was filled with trepidation and fear. And last night, we saw why my heart was filled with trepidation and fear. Because they were not ready for prime time. Because they were not ready for the challenge of the moment. They were not ready to rise up when the situation demanded rising. They were not ready for the big at-bats when the situation demanded a big at-bat. They were not ready to get the big out when the situation demanded the big out. The right pitch, the great fielding play, the difference between victory and loss, losing, or victory and loss in the postseason is oftentimes a matter of inches. You miss a pitch by just an inch or two and keep it in the bat, in the line of the swing of a D.D. Gregorius, and it is the difference between victory and loss. And last night we saw exactly how and exactly why. And Kush, I don't know how they get over this. I don't know how they get over, and I don't know how we as fans, now fans who root for the Tigers listening to us right now are like, yeah, I don't want to hear about you getting over it. You still have the best team in the American League coming back next year. We're rebuilding. We traded Verlander. We traded Martinez. We traded Avila. We're moving most of the big pieces that we have. The only thing left is Miggy. We traded Upton. Tigers fans are probably like, yeah, go soak your head. I don't want to hear about your whining and your moaning. Well, I'm going to whine and I'm going to moan about this. I'm going to whine and I'm going to moan about 3-17. What's 3-17, you ask? Well, over the last 18 years, so that would be going back to 1999. Over the last 18 years, the Indians have played 20 games in which, if they won, they clinch a postseason series. 20 series clinching games. They are 3-17 in such games. Last year, they had 3 of them with a 3-1 series lead. They could have clinched the World Series in Game 5. Did not. Could have done it in game six. Did not. Could have done it in game seven. Did not. This year, a 2-0 series lead. Could have clinched it in game three. Did not. In game four. Did not. In game five. Did not. That's six in the last two seasons alone. That's 3-17 over the last 18 years. And Jim, you wonder, Indians fans wonder, when is the drought going to end from 1948 on? Some people call it the curse of Rocky Colavito. I call those people idiots. But that's what some people call it. Whatever it is, it lives on. And it doesn't appear that having the best team is the overriding factor. It doesn't appear that having the best starter in Kluber is the overriding factor that will end it. It doesn't appear that having the better manager is enough to be the overriding factor. Having 102 regular season wins is not the overriding factor, because when you lose three straight to end the season, well, you end up asking yourself the following question that I will answer as soon as I ask it. And then I'll let you riff for a while, Mr. Cushlin, because I need a moment to process this. When you look back on the 2017 Major League Baseball season for the Indians, every Indian fan within the sound of my voice right now, when you look back on the 2017 Indian season, will you remember it as a successful season or a failure? That's the question. The answer, I'm very sad to say, is that it will have been looked upon as a failure. What? How can it be a failure when you won 102 baseball games? How is it a failure when you set the American League record for consecutive wins with 22 wins? How is it a failure when you have a top five MVP candidate, clearly, and maybe the Cy Young winner? How is it a failure when you win your second straight American League division or Central Division crown? Well, do you remember 2 years ago when the Golden State Warriors set an NBA record with 72 regular season wins? Or so was it 73? What was the record?
72. 72. Yeah, 72 was the old record.
Sorry.
Yeah.
When the Warriors set the NBA's regular season record with 73 victories and then marched through the Western Conference playoffs without much struggle, with the exception of the 3-1 lead they overcame against the Oklahoma City, or 3-1 deficit they overcame against the Oklahoma City Thunder, before meeting the Cleveland Cavaliers and having a 3-1 series lead in the NBA Finals and blowing it as the Cavaliers won the World Championship. Do you remember what we asked on this program and what many people throughout the sporting world asked? Was the season for the Warriors a wasted season, or was it a tremendous success? Was it a successful season or a failure? And I said on this show at that time 2 years ago, and I stand by it, their 73-win season meant nothing. Nothing at all. Because they didn't convert that into the ship. They didn't win another championship. The Bulls won 72 and won a championship. They won 73 and won nothing. That season will be remembered as a failure for the Golden State Warriors. If I'm consistent, and I have to say I may be a lot of things and I may not be a lot of things, but one thing that I am, I try to be, is consistent. If I'm consistent, then I have to look at a 22-game winning streak, and I have to look at the Cy Young Award, and I have to look at the MVP candidate, and I have to look at the 102 wins and the back-to-back division championships. I have to look at all of the above, and then I have to say, what was it worth? Nothing. Not only did you not win the ship, you didn't get out of the first round of the playoffs. You blew a 2-0 lead to the New York Yankees 1 year after losing a 3-1 lead to the Chicago Cubs in the World Series. The season of dreams, the magic, the late-inning heroics, the records, the awards. Pitcher of the month, player of the month, manager of the year, all of the things that are going to be bestowed and have been bestowed upon that team in this magical run toward what was supposed to be a back-to-back World Series appearance and a world championship for the first time since 1948. All of those things have gone by the wayside because they couldn't hit CC Sabathia first and then still got saved in game two, then couldn't touch Masahiro Tanaka, then couldn't touch Luis Severino, and couldn't field the ball, by the way, and then couldn't touch enough CC Sabathia again and that bullpen for the New York Yankees. As they forgot how to hit, they forgot how to pitch, they forgot how to catch, and they forgot that the season was supposed to be a little bit different. Kush, 10 years from now, will you look back at the 2017 Indians and their 102 victories and think, what a great season, or will you think, what a wasted opportunity?
The latter. No question, no hesitation. You know, it's the latter. And the fact that we're sitting here today having to have this, you know, conversation, there are three things to me that are the reason that the Indians lost these three in a row and are now going to watch the rest of October. One, nobody could hit. I mean, you know, we can run down the Lindors and Jose Ramirez and the rest and their batting totals this series. Just know they're a completely atrocious. Nobody remembered how to play good defense, especially a guy who's supposed to be in there for defensive purposes only. You know, I'm not trying to knock Urshela, but he always had a light bat. He was there for his glove. That failed. But the biggest reason is a reason I never, ever thought would even be possible. I never even imagined a scenario where, quite frankly, a big reason we're sitting here having this conversation is because Corey Kluber don't have it. And I'm just utterly shocked that that's one of the top reasons. He did not have it. I don't care if he struck out six in that game yesterday. You heard in some of the montage from Terry Francona, the ball was flat. And that's where Didi Gregorius teed off on it. I never thought we'd be having to have the conversation where you could chalk a lot of blame to Corey Kluber of all people.
Corey Kluber had a horrible series, as we know. We can blame the first game, the second game of the series, his first start in the series, perhaps on being off of his regular rest. He was on 6 days instead of a 5-day rotation. He doesn't like that. This is known. That does not answer game five, because he was. That's why Terry Francona, trying to play the percentages, put him in game two, so that he would be on regular rest for game five rather than for game two. He was on regular rest. And Corey Kluber in the two games allowed 9 runs, 4 homers, in just 6 1/3 innings combined in those two postseason starts, leading many people to wonder whether he is himself because of his performance or whether he was not himself, perhaps, is a better way to say that, because of injury. Remember, he missed an entire month of baseball with a back injury. He missed a month. Was that an issue again? He said, no, I was healthy enough to pitch. But he said, nobody is 100% healthy at this stage of the season, but, quote, I was healthy enough to go out there and try to pitch. Now, Kluber doesn't speak. We know this. Kluber doesn't cry. Kluber doesn't cheer. He doesn't celebrate. That's why they call him Klubot. He's a bleeping, you know, android. Is that it, android? Or am I, is that what the Terminator was?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You get confused because of the phone now.
Right.
He was an android. He's like, you know, he's got human skin over a robotic innards. And for him to say, and I feel like the phrasing of this is key, he said, quote, I don't feel like I need to get into details right now. I was healthy enough to go out there and try to pitch. That to me is about, you know, the most you're ever going to get out of Corey Kluber. If he wasn't 100% healthy with his back, if he wasn't 100% healthy with anything, you're not going to get much more than that. I was healthy enough to go out there and try to pitch. That means I was healthy enough to try to get guys out, which means I didn't do it. So it's about the result. It's about not what went into it, but it's what came out of it. I didn't do my job. Terry Francona said he's fighting a lot. I think you also have to respect the fact that the guy wants to go out there and he's our horse, and sometimes it doesn't work. What does that mean? Fighting a lot. He's fighting a lot, and Kluber says, I was healthy enough to go out there and try to pitch. I don't think they wanted the New York Yankees to know that maybe he wasn't right. And clearly there was no talk about that prior to, so is it fair to talk about that after the fact? Maybe, maybe not. It might sound like some excuse-making for me or from Francona or even Kluber's wording. I was healthy enough to go out there and try to pitch. Code 4, I wasn't 100% healthy, but I went out and gave it a try. I just don't know because he's Klubot. But I'll tell you what, it was an extraordinary letdown. Nobody saw this coming. We gave him a lot of leeway. I think everybody did in Game 7 of the World Series last year, because if you recall, his last two starts in the World Series against the Cubs were both on short rest. He went short rest, short rest. Mm-hmm. Talk about a chance to blow a guy's arm out. He went short rest, and didn't have it in Game 7, and it was understood. It was completely understandable. This was regular rest, actually an extra day rest, and then a regular five-day rotation, and it just wasn't there for him. So there's not a whole lot of... Not a whole lot of ways to look at that other than, you know, he either just choked in the big moment, which I don't think I could imagine him doing, or he really wasn't fully healthy. And that's not something he's going to admit to. He might drop a little hint or two about I was healthy enough to go out there and try, and that's the end of it. That's all I'm going to say. But I don't think we'll know. So the disappointment is heavy. The disappointment is far heavier for Indians fans today and last night than the disappointment even was for Michigan fans when they dropped Saturday's in-state battle against quote-unquote little brother, who quite frankly has become big brother to the Wolverines, when the Wolverines lost to Michigan State. We're going to talk about that loss, and we're going to talk about the bounce-back opportunities for the Wolverines this week at Bloomington against Indiana. The voice of the Wolverines, Jim Brandstatter, is going to be joining us after the bottom of the hour Sports Center and after your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, Wings, Beer, Sports.
Yeah, you knew the Wild Stat was going to be related to the ALDS loss last night. Now that the Indians have lost in that division series, add their name to the list of 100-plus win teams that have failed in the playoffs. Since the beginning of the division series era, which began in 1995, there have been 26 teams that had 100 or more wins. Of those, nearly half, 12 of them, lost the division series. And by the way, on the other side of the coin, only 3 out of the 26 went on to win the World Series. That's your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. All right, here's what we got. We're going to get a bottom of the hour local sports center with Kush coming up. Then we're going to talk college football to take our minds off the misery of the end of the baseball season, if you happen to be rooting for the Tribe. Jim Brandstatter, voice of the Wolverines, joins us next.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
We had a ball game that, you know, stuff happens. We had fumbles. We had turnovers. We had things that just occurred. We had a shotgun snap to their quarterback. He fumbles it and then picks up a critical first down. I mean, things happen, and they, during the course of the game, you don't necessarily know why they're happening, but they keep happening, and that's where you go back and you learn from it, you look at it, the corrections, and you move on to, with the mindset of not letting it happen again.
Yes, indeed. That's the boss. Coach Jim Harbaugh talking about the loss to the Michigan State Wolverines. Big brother, little brother. I think that can kind of be put to bed for a while. Unless the Wolverines are willing to acknowledge they are now the little brother. Maybe just let's stop that comparison altogether because it's not looking good. Mark D'Antonio takes care of business again against a Jim Harbaugh team in year 3. And the question is what do the Wolverines do to turn this thing around heading to Bloomington? Back-to-back road games, by the way. Bloomington then at number 4-ranked Penn State on the 21st. Joining us now to talk all things Wolverines football is the voice of the Michigan Wolverines on the Wolverines Radio Network, Jim Brandstatter, back with us again here in Toledo. Jim, so kind of you to join us again, sir. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you doing?
Lousy, because I want to see Michigan win. I want to see an undefeated Michigan team in the conference going against an undefeated Ohio State team at the end of the season, you know, for a spot in the conference championship game the way it used to be, and we're not going to get that now.
I like that, too, the way it used to be, but that's not going to happen. You're right.
Yeah, it's
Yeah, I mean, before we get into some of the specifics, Jim, about where the team is right now and, of course, the loss to the Spartans, I just want to get some clarification as much as you can or as much as you know about Wilton Spade and what multiple weeks really means. You read different articles from different people, and some say it's 3 weeks, some say it's the rest of the season. What do you know about Wilton Spade's condition and how much of an impact that is having on this Michigan offense?
Well, I mean, clearly he was a starting quarterback, and you don't lose your starting quarterback without it having an impact to some degree. Now, I don't know either. I'm not a doctor, but I do know that the diagnosis and what they have seen is there are cracked vertebrae. And I'm not a back specialist. I don't know what that means, and I don't know how severe it is. I'm sure that he's getting weekly, if not a couple of times a week, every day treatment, but some kind of diagnosis to see how that's repairing itself and how to repair it. And until it's ready to go, the doctor's not going to clear him to play. And that's strictly up to the medical professionals.
So that's why all these articles are telling us different things, because nobody really knows.
Nobody knows. I mean, it's the old story. Everybody's body heals differently.
Sure.
And with a vertebrae, with a back, houses the spinal column, you are very, very careful. And that's one of the things that doctors will not fool around with. That head injuries, neck injuries, those are injuries you do not fool around with, and you only allow a guy to go back and play when you are sure and 100% ready that they will not do any more damage if they get hit in a certain area.
No doubt about that at all, Jim. And I want to talk now about, because when I said what kind of an impact it has, well, the obvious is that he's the starting quarterback and he's not there. But the backup quarterback is a very experienced college quarterback, fifth-year senior John O'Korn. My question is, because they're different types of guys who play the game a little bit differently, how much do you think Jim Harbaugh had to change the offense against Michigan State because of O'Korn being the guy now, if much at all? Or is it, nope, we run the same plays no matter who's under center?
I don't think it was as much as people think. Because let's remember, these two guys have been in the same system for 2 years. So and the same coordinator has been there for 2 years, and the coordinator's understanding of each one's abilities and capabilities as regards to what he can do offensively. Now, the one thing I will tell you is O'Korn has probably got a little bit more mobility from a standpoint of pure running the football. I think that Wilton was escapable and very capable of moving around in the pocket and buying time. John O'Korn has better running ability to maybe scramble and get more yardage. That's the only difference between the two. Other than that, I see no difference in what they did offensively. You may see a few more heavy sets with big 3 and 4 tight ends in the game with O'Korn than you did with Spate. But on balance, I think it's pretty much the same offense.
We are talking with Jim Brandstatter, the voice of the Michigan Wolverines, former Michigan offensive lineman, of course, as well, talking about the loss to Michigan State. So how do you analyze this? You know, I mean, a part of me just says, look, you know, we know, and you and I talked about this a few weeks ago when you were kind enough to join us again, Jim, about how the number of starters they lost, 10 starters on defense, 7 starters on offense, you're going to have a lot of young players playing. But it's not like they didn't play. A lot of the new starters got time last year. But still, it's a new team in many respects, and to expect them to win every rivalry game and every big game against a top 10 team, I think, is a little bit much. So part of me wants to give a little bit of, you know, a little bit of leeway here to Jim Harbaugh and the guys, but then part of me is very disappointed if I'm a Michigan fan, because again, you know, it's a rivalry game between Michigan State and Ohio State. These things just haven't gone Harbaugh's way. So how do you term it from that standpoint?
I'm feeling the same way. I mean, I don't like losing to Michigan State. The one thing I would say in regards to, you know, the new kids, I don't think defensively there was a problem in the Michigan-Michigan State game. I mean, they scored 14 points in the first half. I thought they played well. I thought they fooled Michigan on a couple of occasions, including the one screen pass. But in the second half, Michigan State didn't move the ball across the street. I mean, they got two first downs. They didn't come till a minute left to go in the game.
That's right, yeah.
So to suggest that defensively they had issues, I think at halftime they adjusted for the most part, if you look at the stats and you look at the X's and O's, more efficiently and effectively than Michigan State did. Because Michigan State didn't do anything offensively. the problem, and the problem in that whole game, and the problem all season, I think from Purdue, even in Air Force to a degree, their offense just wasn't able to move the football consistently. And here's the deal. It comes to, I think, what you have up front. And if you can't protect the quarterback and mount a running game when you need to run it, if they're lining up with 8-9 guys in there and you can still pound out 3 and 4 yards, then I think that's where you put a defense at a real disadvantage. And right now Michigan's been unable to, you know, protect O'Korn and Wilton Spate. We see Wilton Spate out of the game because of a hit he took against Purdue. And quarterbacks have to be protected. And that, to me, they've got to solve that issue up front going forward. And because I think defensively they can play with anybody. But it's running the ball, and that's not just running backs. And the pass protection isn't just the offensive line. You see blitzes coming in where running backs are missing blocks or not picking up the right blitzes. And it's one mistake on one snap, and from 2nd and 6, you go to 3rd and 18. Those are the ones that kill you. And that's what was happening to Michigan. So if you're looking for, you know, where I think that, you know, they need to get better, to me, it's in that area. Protect the quarterback and run the ball more consistently.
Very well said, especially spoken by former offensive lineman. You're right about all of those things. Jim Brandstatter joining us, the voice of the Wolverines. Our man Jim Cushlin is sitting alongside me here. He's got a question for you, Jim.
Speaking of banged up guys, read a story a couple of days ago, Jim, that they're thinking of changing out some guys in the wide receiver core. The story goes that Drake Harris, they're going to move him back from the secondary, which they just put him in during the spring, in the spring game and spring practices, because of the obvious, you know, loss from last season in that secondary. Well, now you got an underperforming wide receiver core, and Tariq Black's out, so Drake Harris back to wide receiver. Is this going to work? Is there going to be a time, you know, progression here to get his quote-unquote legs back under him, or will we notice that he's back there?
It's hard to tell. I mean, part of the reason is I think you might see a freshman, Nico Collins. He was on the trip a week ago. He might get an opportunity to play a little bit some. And it's not just Tariq Black that's hurt. Nate Shanley, who was going to get some time, he hurt his foot against Purdue. He hasn't been able to go. So they've had some injuries, too, that they're bringing guys in to see if they can get going. And the fact that Eddie McDoom and, you know, Kakoa Crawford haven't performed and haven't gotten the numbers that they feel they should. I think, you know, you add depth to that receiving core. Right now they feel comfortable with their cornerback situation. Brandon Watson, Levert Hill, young freshman Ambry Thomas, and Long, David Long. Those guys all have played well. I think they feel comfortable with their quarterback situation. And Drake Harris now is kind of a luxury there. So you move him over where you've lost some depth through injuries. And I don't think it'll take him long to pick it up. He's only been gone, what, 3-4 weeks in reality? And he's had all last year and time this year, to get back into it. So if they choose to move him, I don't think it's going to be, you know, that long for him to get back up to speed.
Jim, let's talk just a minute or two about Indiana and the matchup here. I thought this was worded well. If you like punting, this might be the game for you. And this is part of the preview from ESPN. Two top teams in the country defensively in 3 and outs. Are coming in. I was pointed out by Tom Allen, the Indiana coach. Both of these teams do like to get off of the field defensively quickly, and they do so. So something's got to give here. Hoosiers are 3-2. You obviously just sang the praises of the Michigan defense against Michigan State. So how does the offense attack the Hoosier defense?
Well, I mean, you got to block them. I mean, let's face it. I mean, it doesn't change from last week to this week in regards to what Michigan brings to the table. I mean, they're trying some new combinations up in the offensive line. Bushel Beatty got a lot of time last week instead of Eluzio at the right tackle spot. So I'm sure that the competition is continuing during the week of practice. And, you know, running backs. And the big thing is, you can't turn it over 5 times. If you're playing the Little Sisters of the Poor, if you turn it over 5 times, you're not going to have a great chance to win. So you've got to hold on to the football. And you're going to have to play a field position game, and you're going to have to take advantage of your opportunities. You can't have big mistakes at key moments. So how do you attack Indiana? You don't make mistakes. You do your thing. The big thing I think Michigan's going to have to do is There's a new quarterback at Indiana. Peyton Ramsey got to start a week ago. He is a redshirt freshman, and he's a little bit more mobile, a little bit more of a read option, if you will, type quarterback. And that was what hurt Michigan's defense a week ago against Michigan State. Lewerke was able to scramble out of there on some plays that they had defended well enough, and Lewerke was able to, you know, bleed some yardage through a scramble and ad-libbing. And I think that that's what Ramsey's capable of doing. So, in my opinion, they got to spy Ramsey, but the reality of life is you got to block their front and you got to move the ball on the ground and protect your quarterback. If you do that, this offense will start to go.
Jim, when you're coming off a loss, there's no reason anything should be a trap game for you. Obviously, you got to focus on the task at hand. You're coming off a loss. Having said that, however, Penn State looms next week. Any concern in your mind that anybody might be looking at that challenge, considering they're about to play a team that they've beaten 21 straight times in the series?
No. You just got spanked 14-10 by your rival. If anybody's thinking past Indiana to Penn State and playing at night in Happy Valley, they probably shouldn't be on the trip. It's about winning now. It's about getting that taste out of your mouth. And I just don't think there will be any thought of that at all, especially coming off a 14-10 loss to your arch rival across the state. You gotta close ranks, circle the wagons, and get it back, and get it back fast. And you don't do that by looking ahead 2 weeks.
I think that's very well said, and I wouldn't expect it anything else, but boy, that is going to be quite the showdown, undefeated Penn State looming in prime time. Last thing, going back to John O'Korn, just to talk about how much prep Brandon Peters might be getting behind him. I mean, obviously, you know, you have to have a great or a good or a quality or a sound or a solid backup quarterback ready to go in the event, as we found out when Wilton Spate went down and good O'Korn is there, but now if something happens, he takes the wrong kind of hit. We're talking about a guy who's thrown one collegiate pass. Are you aware of how many reps that Peters is getting in practice just in the event?
The only thing I can tell you is that he's getting the same number of reps that any backup would normally get.
Okay.
And the one thing I know that Jim Harbaugh has learned is you got to go into any game, you got to have two quarterbacks ready. And so that backup will get the same plays. He may not get as many reps, but he will get backup reps, and they will be partly with first unit guys, so that the speed and you know the kind of familiarity with players will be there to the backup, and he'll be in the quarterback meeting rooms. He'll be doing everything that the starters do. He just may not get as many reps, but he'll get the same number of backup reps that John O'Korn got when Wilton Spate was healthy and ready to go.
Makes sense, indeed. Although the reason I asked, of course, is because O'Korn, you know, wasn't a raw newbie, when he was the backup because he had all that experience.
Yeah.
Whereas a guy like Peters, like I said, hasn't, he's thrown one pass in college football so far. And
right. No,
his
backup,
McCaffrey, has not even taken a snap yet. So.
Right. And I wouldn't think you'd use McCaffrey because there's a young freshman quarterback that I think you'd want to use your red shirt on him that he has 4 years of eligibility after this year. Because you've got three quality quarterbacks right now. With Wilton going out, going into the season, you had three.
Sure. And I'll tell you what, I think both of those two young guys, the redshirt and the true freshman, Peters and McCaffrey, are both tremendous. And I don't know how it's going to play out in the next
season. I agree. And, you know, this is a great opportunity for Brandon Peters, who last spring, many people felt, had an opportunity to compete for the starting job this fall.
Yep.
But both O'Korn and Spate had kind of passed him by. But now he's got a great opportunity, and he comes out of Avon, Indiana, with a tremendous reputation, a lot of upside potential, and you know it's about getting it done though. And we all wonder, we all stand on the sidelines and see him Saturday. Don't forget, the coaches see him Monday through Friday in practice. They see him in the meeting rooms. They see him against the blackboard, the whole nine yards. So they're making informed decisions based on a whole lot more information than you and I get.
Absolutely right. And Jim Brandstetter, it is so good to get your analysis and breakdown of all things Wolverines, including the matchup in Bloomington coming up on Saturday. Have a great call of that game, Jim, and thanks for spending some time talking to Michigan fans down here in Northwest Ohio.
No problem. Appreciate it. You guys take care.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. God bless. Jim Brandstetter, such a great guy to talk to. I love days like this, by the way, because this is, you know, I don't know, this is just a treat because you get to talk to the voices of the Wolverines and the Buckeyes back to back, and that's just awesome. So, yeah, from Brandstetter, we go to Paul Keels coming up here after the top of the hour Sports Center, and I'm very, very much looking forward to that. Hey, and since we're talking about Ohio State and Michigan and college football here a little bit this Thursday afternoon, pretty good time to remind you of the Border Battle Contest. If you would like to go to the Big House and watch the Buckeyes and Wolverines, this is your opportunity. From ESPN 106.5 The Ticket in Yingling, a chance to go to that game November 25 in Ann Arbor with limo service. Yeah, travel to the Big House in style from Total Image Limousine. The runner-up, by the way, to this great contest, the Border Battle Contest, gets a trip for two to the Big Ten Championship game December 2 at Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. So for a chance to qualify, just register one time at 1065theticket.com. That's the website. Register for the Border Battle Contest. Or text the word Border Battle. One word, combine it together, Border Battle, to 64636. Those who qualify will attend our giveaway party on Thursday night, November 16th at the Blarney downtown. And you will find out if you are the grand prize or the runner-up prize winner. All from Yingling, True House of Munch, Get Go Transportation, Churchill's, Country Hearth, Tass Electronics, Distracted Haunted House, and your football freaks right here at the Ticket. All right, so we got a top of the hour local sports center coming up. We're then going to talk to Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, get a little bit of his thoughts on a couple of blowout wins that the Buckeyes have been able to put together against Rutgers and Maryland, see if the challenge will be any better against Nebraska in Lincoln. So Paul Keels is coming up, and then we're probably going to dive right back into baseball again. The post-mortem, if you will, on a season that died way, way, way too soon for Indians fans after the Game 5 and the Division Series collapse completed last night at Progressive Field out there in Cleveland. So all of that still coming up when hour number two commences here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
We felt good about ourselves. You know, we came down the stretch playing very good baseball, and we did some things in this series that I don't think were characteristic of our team. We made some errors, kicked the ball around a little bit. You know, sometimes you don't swing the bat. That's part of it. But we made it harder to win in some cases, especially the last two games. You know, nobody wanted the season to be over. It doesn't wind down. It comes to a crashing halt. Nobody, myself included, was ready for it to be over. You know, started out, I thought first inning was, came out of the chute good. You know, he didn't locate the first home run to Didi. I just thought quickly his stuff was starting to trend down. You know, even the last thing, he got a strikeout on a hanging breaking ball. Just wasn't the normal crisp, you know, especially the movement. A lot of pitches were flat. You know, whatever you say isn't going to make anybody feel better tonight. We win together and we lost together. It was an honor to go through this year with these guys. And there's times that hurt, like tonight. I don't know if I'm ready to even think about guys moving on. We're 8 minutes from digesting a loss. The game's still a little too raw to go into that yet.
We had a ball game that, you know, stuff happens. We had fumbles. We had turnovers. We had things that just occurred. We had a shotgun snap to their quarterback. He fumbles it and then picks up a critical first down. I mean, things happen and during the course of the game, you don't necessarily know why they're happening, but they keep happening. And that's where you go back and you learn from it. You look at it. You make corrections and you move on to, with the mindset of not letting it happen again. I can understand a quarterback question and, you know, there being a quarterback controversy. We'd never really discuss a, you know, right tackle or a guard or a center controversy. We look forward to getting back today and doing everything on both sides of the ball and in special team to contribute to a victory. And we're fortunate to have an opponent to play this week and opportunities ahead of us.
Yeah, I think night games present unique challenges, just like noon games. We have a really good routine that we adjust every year according to our performance. And Coach Mick's in charge of that. And so it is tough. It's to sit around a hotel and all that, but that's, you know, life in the big city. The comments made earlier this week are more about the post. Because we land and I drive home, I get home about 4:30. They're on a bus. They pull in after 5 o'clock in the morning. I can hear the TV people or administrators or conference office people, you know, anybody with common sense would look at that and say, we got to have a conversation about this.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, we roll onward into hour number two at 9 minutes past 4 o'clock. Thanks again to the great Jim Brandstetter, the voice of the Wolverines, for talking about the loss to Little Bro, Michigan State again, and how they're going to have to try to raised the stakes a little bit and certainly raised their level of play in all areas against the Indiana Hoosiers at Bloomington. And we go from the Wolverines to the Buckeyes. How can we possibly not? We follow up Mr. Brandstetter with the voice of the Buckeyes, a voice you hear each and every time there is Ohio State football on the radio network and right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. It belongs to Mr. Paul Keels, who joins us once again. Paul, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very good, Bob. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. Boy, I'll tell you what. Not as good as Urban right now, though. I mean, I feel like we could have canned the interview we did 3 weeks ago and replayed it each of these 3 weeks, and that is, hey, Paul, I started out with, hey, Paul, what can you learn from a win like that? Because it started with UNLV 54-21, then Rutgers 56-0, now Maryland 62-14, and it's just, you know, what do you learn from a win against an overmatched opponent in dominating fashion like that? I feel like I'm a broken record here by asking you the same question.
Well, and I feel like a broken record with the same answers, and it's a lot of the same things. It's getting a lot of guys an opportunity to play, guys that didn't get in the first 2 weeks, guys that need some development. But most importantly, I think it's momentum, it's rhythm, it's, you know, the passing game looks better than it did in the first 2 weeks, but as Urban has said, they're realistic about who they've played. The pass defense looks better, but again, you take it with a grain of salt considering who they've played. But, you know, the thing I guess you can't substitute is the feeling of winning and getting a victory and trying to put themselves in the best position they can to be ready for, you know, the meat of the schedule which comes up. So, you know, I guess that's the thing you have to say, Bob, that they've gained out of those games.
Yeah, and you know, the meat of the schedule, to be quite honest, isn't really here yet, even as we look at this this Nebraska team that is just, you know, all is not well in the land of the corn. You know, this is a rough time for Nebraska. They're coming off a 38-17 loss to then number 9 Wisconsin. Now, of course, the Buckeyes are number 9. You know, they've lost to a MAC team, Northern Illinois. First time in school history that has happened. Their quarterback has thrown 10 interceptions, which has got to have Ohio State secondary just, you know, foaming at the mouth right now. Tanner Lee talking about a Big Ten worst 10 interceptions. So this isn't really the meat yet either. Is this something that, you know, how does Urban approach the troops for this game mentally?
Well, I think it's a lot of the same thing, and especially with it being on the road. I know that probably will help get everybody's attention and at least give the coaches some ammunition. And you're right about Nebraska. The turnovers by Tanner Lee at quarterback have been a big undoing. They've dealt with a lot of injury on both sides of the ball, especially, you know, they lost an All-American cornerback in the summer who just came back and played last week for the first time. So injuries have been a part of it. You know, and let's not take anything away from Wisconsin and how good we think they might be. But, you know, this is an opportunity for them to try and continue the momentum, to get a road victory, go into a bye weekend feeling good about what they've done, you know, post Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and then get ready for that matchup with Penn State and so on and so on. So it's, you know, and the other thing that Urban talks about in his coaches, even when it's an overmatched opponent, he makes it about them, about themselves. You know, what can we do to get better? What can we do to improve what we've done? And that's just kind of something that he's always been banging the gavel about ever since he got here.
To that end, is there anything you can nitpick from the Maryland game where you could say, you know what, I mean, I'm just looking at box scores, you know, 20 out of 31 for JT. Obviously a dominating win. He threw 3 touchdown passes. But if I'm being that way, I can say, well, that's 11 incompletions against a team that perhaps you shouldn't have 11 incompletions against. Is there anything that you can look at and say, this needs to be tightened up when we face a better opponent?
Well, the biggest thing from last week is special teams. You know, he gave up a 100-yard kickoff return for a touchdown, had a botched PAT try, a blocked field goal attempt, and a punt that I think was about 20 yards. Now, they've been pretty good at the punting and the kicking part of it. So when those things kind of happen, it really gets your attention, especially the 100-yard kickoff return. It came right after Ohio State had scored on the defensive touchdown. So that's kind of been, and you know how coaches are, they're always going to focus more on what needs to be worked on rather than what's gone well. So those are the things. And yeah, there's some of the other stuff, and plus the injury to Brandon Bowen at right guard. Was something that really took a lot of air out of it, too. So, you know, it could be 66-0, but they're still, it's just the nature of coaches. They're still going to find things that, as they call them around the Woody Gaze Complex, Buckeye reminders.
I like that, by the way. We're talking to Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes. Buckeyes getting set for Saturday's battle in Lincoln, primetime again, 7:30 against Nebraska. You know, I don't care who the opponent is. When it's a conference opponent, they have to be given the respect of being a Big Ten team. When you hold a Big Ten team to 66 total yards, I mean, that's just something. Even after you take out your starting defense and you got your twos and threes in there just flying around and getting after it like that against some of their twos and threes, and, of course, they're on their third quarterback. So that was right from the very beginning. But you understand the point. Even you know, with the acknowledgement that it's not necessarily the strongest opponent, it's a Big Ten team that you just held to 66 total yards of offense. I mean, their total was trumped by that 100-yard return that you mentioned. So, I mean, defensively, what can you say about the way these guys are getting after it?
Well, I think it's kind of, especially with that defensive line group, it's the standard that we've come to expect, you know, really dating back to John Cooper's days. And a lot of that, Bob, has to do with all of the different guys that are playing. And, you know, this week they get two more. They get Draymond Jones back, who had been out the last 2 weeks with a leg injury. And they get Michael Hill back, who had been suspended since before the season started. So that defensive line has just, you know, continued to be what they've been the last few years. And it's allowed the linebackers to make plays. And I think it also has helped that secondary kind of get their own traction and really get settled into some things.
Paul, looking at the big picture, and just kind of looking around the nation at like what happened to Oklahoma, how much do you think, and there's still a lot of football to be played, we're not even in November, heck, we're not even at the halfway point yet of October, but when all is said and done and the committee starts to look at potential playoff teams, you know, we all wondered how much would the loss to Oklahoma hurt, and if Oklahoma was an undefeated team, you know, you might say, well, not as much. I mean, they're a dominant team, and then they went ahead and lost to Iowa State. How much do you think that will, in the long run, big picture, affect the Buckeyes considering that loss?
I think right now it affects them a lot, but what I think Ohio State has in front of them will help their own case. Maybe not put it all in their own hands, but, you know, a win over Penn State, a win at Iowa, a win over Michigan and Michigan State, for that matter, and then if they get to the Big Ten championship game, ostensibly maybe to play Wisconsin, I think that helps their case. But you're right. The Oklahoma loss to Iowa State did not help Ohio State. They needed the Sooners to be running the table and looking good doing it. That did not help. And you know, you said in the big picture, I think, you know, what really is interesting now, Clemson and Alabama are kind of separating themselves from everybody else. And, you know, so that kind of shrinks the sample size a little bit for everybody else. You know, who else becomes part of this? Is there a group of five team like a San Diego State that becomes a party crasher? I don't know if we'll see that happen, but, you know, if you're in the position Ohio State's in now, that's maybe something you have to think about. But really all they can control is what they do. And, you know, and if, you know, being as optimistic as possible, if they run the table all the way through Indianapolis, then I think what they've done there is at least put themselves in the discussion. I don't know if it's enough, but they've put themselves in the discussion.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, when you run it down that way and you look at the teams they would have to beat to run the table, as you mentioned, number three, Penn State. In and of itself, Penn State would be just a huge win. But,
sure.
Yeah, you have to do Michigan State, too, even though they're not a, you know, a top 25 team. And we'll see where Michigan ends up, obviously, by the time they face one another. They got dinged big time for that loss, of course, dropping all the way down to 17. But it's still a rivalry game. Even if they're top 20 or 25, it's a rivalry game, and they're going to get lots of credit for that in terms of the, you know, the committee and style points or whatever it is that you want to call it. So you're right. I mean, there's still a ton of things that they have to accomplish that could make that Oklahoma game just matter a little bit less each and every victory.
Yeah, and you also have to hope that Oklahoma continues to take care of their business now from here on out, because, you know, another loss by Oklahoma anywhere further dims it a little bit for Ohio State. But, you know, if Ohio State doesn't take care of all of their other stuff, like you said, Bob, then it kind of has become a moot point.
You mentioned the separation that Alabama and Clemson are kind of, you know, putting between themselves and everyone else right now. Who's better?
You know, I haven't had a chance to see much of Clemson.
Okay.
So I would be improper by choosing one, but boy, Alabama just looks like a machine. And you know, I'm kind of curious why we haven't heard more about Jalen Hurts as possibly a Heisman candidate. So I don't know that I can best answer that. I've been thinking about more who's number three and who's number four. I think, you know, we got to look at Washington maybe as the next team to talk about possibly. And, you know, think about this. How about Washington and Washington State if they're unbeaten when they play in their Apple Cup game at the end of the year? You know, that makes for some interesting spectating.
They're five and eight right now, number 5 and 8 respectively, with Washington in the upper spot. And you know, of course, we talked about the Big Ten before as well. You know, Penn State is 3, and Wisconsin is sitting there at 7, while the Buckeyes are at 9-2. So again, 3. So these things are all going to sort themselves out within conference play, at least as far as, you know, everybody. Well, I don't want to say everybody, but a lot of teams that might be playoff contenders that are going to have one loss. They're going to have to explain away or overcome or have explained for them to the committee why that one loss is better than this one loss. The Buckeyes at least will approach this thing. I always circle back to the Ohio State thing. The Buckeyes, you know, will at least have the benefit of time. We all know that it's better to lose earlier than later. One loss in late October or in November certainly is a lot more damaging than losing in early September, and then you have a whole season to build your resume back up.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the other crucial point for Ohio State, they broke some new ground last year by getting in without playing in your conference championship game. I don't think they can afford to have that happen this year. That plays into what you were talking about, taking care of what's in front of you. And it will be interesting to see if there's somebody that we've not discussed and we're not thinking about off the top of our head who all of a sudden becomes part of this and makes things a little interesting.
Last thing, Paul, I just want to kind of get your thoughts on Nick Saban. It was, you know, the line that kind of, I don't know, I think people, I mean, a lot of people laughed at and a lot of people were just kind of cringing at. Praise from the media for his guys is rat poison. I don't want my guys listening to you tell them how good they are. I want them listening to me telling them how bad they are. That's how I motivate them. How do you take that from Saban, and do you think anybody else feels that way? Does Urban not want his guys reading the traditional headlines and reading and listening to sports talk radio talk about how great they are? Or does he feel this kind of the same way, that it's like a rat poison?
I don't think Urban looks at it that extremely. He acknowledges and gives his guys the benefit of the doubt of knowing that they're smart young men, that they can read all of those things, but within the confines of their practice facility, keep it within the perspective that they have to. I'm not sure where the whole thing from Nick Saban came from, and I know that, you know, this isn't the first time he's gotten a little testy like that. I know from their longtime radio announcer, he says they have a good working relationship, and Nick is fantastic with all of the stuff that he has to do with him. So, that was a little disturbing.
That's the reason I asked, because I was initially disturbed, Paul, but then I read some saying you've got to know Nick and his relationship with that media there, that most of that was tongue-in-cheek. You know, by saying it the way that he did, he's putting on a show there a little bit for the national crowd, that the guys in the room got it, but that the people watching it on TV or hearing it on the radio didn't, that's just kind of Nick being Nick as far as, the way he's playing with people.
Well, and he wouldn't be the first coach to try and use the media to get a message across to players either.
Not at all. No question about that. Paul Keels is the voice of the Buckeyes. Obviously, he'll have a great call with the Buckeyes primetime 7:30 on Saturday in Lincoln, Nebraska against the Huskers. Probably not a close game in store, but boy, oh boy, what they've got waiting for them the next week at Penn State. Paul, we look forward to it. Against Penn State. Paul, we look forward to it. Thanks so much for the time.
All right, you got it, Bob. Take care.
Have a good one. There you go. So there you have it. You've got actually, hold on a second. I'm trying to get my bearings here. They have a bye week between Nebraska and Penn State, don't they, Cush?
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
Because I just got done asking Jim Brandstetter about Michigan potentially looking ahead to Penn State. And then I looked at my schedule and I said, wait a minute, how can they be looking ahead to Penn State when Ohio State's got to play Penn State? Oh, wait a minute, there is a bye week. So the Wolverines will face the Nittany Lions on the 21st.
Right.
The Buckeyes will sit that day and heal up and get ready. Boy, what a break in the schedule for the Buckeyes. What a nice time to have a bye week scheduled before the showdown with number 3. Penn State. So that'll be on October 28th. So for now, for the Buckeyes, obviously, as we point out, it's all about getting ready for those Cornhuskers. Hey, I want to do something cool before we take a time out here. And I want to give actually two cool things. I want to give you two chances at prizes. Well, the first one isn't a prize. This is a special deal going on for ticket listeners today from our friends at the Haunted Hydro. Out in Fremont, this is so cool, as you know, in the Halloween season. Just today only, which means you kind of got to pick up the phone soon because it's already 424. Pick up the phone and text the word HYDRO, all lowercase letters, H-Y-D-R-O. Text HYDRO to the number 64636, and you'll get a ticket to the Haunted HYDRO for just $13 for the whole HYDRO Haunted House, and you can add an escape room ticket for only an extra $2. That's a very, very steep discount off the regular prices. So if you want Haunted HYDRO discount tickets, today only for ticket listeners, text the word HYDRO to 64636, and we will hook you up there. Now, I say one is a prize, one is a special deal. That's the special deal. The prize, staying in the college football front, Cush, is we've got one more pair of tickets to Bowling Green and OU. BG, flying high and feeling good after getting off the schneid, coming off of their first MAC win of the season, first win of the season, period, and it came in a MAC game over Miami of Ohio, 37-29 back on Saturday. So this time, they are back home at the Deut against the Bobcats. So BG and OU at the Deut got a pair of tickets to caller 5 at 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. We'll set you up with BG and OU tickets, see if they can make it two in a row in MAC play, which would be outstanding. Other than that, we're going to get a timeout here. We're going to get ourselves a bottom-of-the-hour local sports center coming your way. Then we want to open up the phone lines about a number of things, not the least of which is the post-mortem on the American League Division Series that ended too soon. Post-mortem on a Cleveland Indians season that ended far, far too soon. And how it is that they allowed another two-game lead with three chances to close out a playoff series to get away from them for the second consecutive year. We'll talk about all of that at 866-240-1065 after the local sports center coming up right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, rolling onward, it's 4:33, 27 minutes of outstanding awesome left for you before drive time with Mr. Mike Miller off today. It's Mr. Jim Cushlin sitting in for drive time, so make sure you stay with us at 5 o'clock. Congratulations to Ken Nagy of Oregon, who won the Bowling Green tickets for BG and OU. Now, if you don't have tickets to the Deut and you're not watching a game in the stadium, you got to find another place to watch your football games. You know where that is? I'll tell you right now, it's at B-Dubs. Buffalo Wild Wings, the best place to watch football. This season, they've gone above and beyond to make it your perfect man cave. Countless taps on tap, HD screens everywhere, and they've created the perfect atmosphere for football, including food and drink specials, like the classic menu item they brought up, the 35th Weck sandwich, and featuring for a limited time only, the Blue Moon barbecue sauce. Check those out. And there's a lot more, but you got to go in to find out what to the place with the best football experience outside of being at the game itself. Buffalo Wild Wings, wings, beer, sports, please drink responsibly. Always. A lot of people felt like drinking last night when they were watching the Indian season come to a premature end. Corey Kluber, the ace, was on the hill for the Indians against the Yankees. The ace, who went in the second half since the All-Star break, 11-1. With an ERA of 1.79 to push him into clear front-runner status for the American League Cy Young Award. Couldn't get it done. In two starts against the hated Yankees, Kluber gave up four home runs in just 6 1/3 innings, putting up a 12.79 ERA. It was Clayton Kershaw-like. You know, dominant regular season, struggled in the postseason. Nobody could figure out exactly what had happened. And to this point, nobody really knows. Terry Francona was asked, was Kluber fully healthy or was he fighting some sort of a back problem? Francona said, you know what, I think he's fighting a lot. And I think you also have to respect the fact that the guy wants to go out there and he's our horse, but sometimes it just doesn't work. Kluber, stoic as always, won't speak, or not speak, I should say, won't show a lot of emotion, simply answered every question with his vague half answers that he always does. He said, I don't think anybody is 100% this time of the year. I was good enough to go out there and try to compete. I don't know if I need to go into, get into the details, but I was healthy enough to go out there and try to pitch. And just like that, well, not just like that. Jim, you know, you kind of surprised me, Cush, in the first half hour of the show when we were kind of reminiscing on the end of the season, which was far too premature for virtually everybody's taste. I mean, I don't care who you are, right? I mean, we talked about this the other day. Even if you're listening to us in Northwest Ohio and you're a Tigers fan, particularly because, you know, you just have the affiliation, you know, with the Hens and all. But if you're a Tigers fan, you still have to hate the Yankees, right? You still have to be disappointed about this. Not as much as Indians fans would be, clearly, but you have to be disappointed that the Yankees, especially with the full-on Yankee Entertainment System network, the YES Network that FS1 became in this series, I mean all on pro New York. Anything and everything that happened that good for New York was blown up into, you know, the stratosphere with the excitement of the announcers and the shots of the Yankee dugout. Mm-hmm. And everything that the Indians did was just like, oh, and a base hit to right scores Austin Jackson. You know, and it was so blatantly obvious. I'm hoping that everybody in America from Cleveland particularly, but through Toledo, and I don't care where, from coast to coast and border to border, is rooting for the Houston Astros. Just because you know damn well that the networks are rooting for the New York Yankees.
Well, if, you know, from that Tigers fan point of view, you know, go to the other side in the alternate universe where the Indians did win, I would fully expect Tigers fans to root against the Indians in the in an ALCS just because of the whole Verlander to Houston thing at bare minimum. But now I get your point on the Fox Sports 1 broadcast. That is what it is. It doesn't, you know, it no longer shocks me when the national guys are going to be pro-New York or pro-Cubs like Foxworth last year.
Have at least some semblance of you know, of objectivity. I mean, make it at least, you know, pretend. Give the viewer. Jim, I almost tweeted during the game last night. Does Matt Vasgersian know that the game is being broadcast in Cleveland? You know, that was one of my thoughts. The people in Cleveland and the people who root for the Indians, no matter where they might be, listening to that broadcast and watching that game have to be just freaking throwing things at the pro-New York. I mean, it's just like everything. God, I got to give it up to these Yankees. Even before the game is over, it was 1-0. Boy, to come back like this. It's just, oh, my God, Didi Gregorius. The pro-Yankee crap would probably be very, very welcome in Manhattan and in the Bronx and in Brooklyn. Yes. But do they know that this is not a local broadcast? Do they have any idea that the game is being broadcast in the place where the Indians have fans? You know, like Cleveland. Do they know that they're broadcasting from Cleveland in this game? It's just so aggravating. I cannot tell you, and I'm normally not this guy. I don't like to gripe like this about that. But it takes all of the enjoyment, even in victory, Jim. Even in victory in game one with the dominant start by Bauer, in game two with the amazing comeback in 13 innings, it still sucks some of the enjoyment out of it to listen to them with their pro-Yankee homerism. And again, if I'm listening to a Yankee broadcast, I get it. You know, Matt Underwood and Rick Manning on the TV broadcast for the Indians, they are very, very pro-Indians. They're supposed to be. Tom Hamilton on the radio call, very pro. And I get it. If I was listening to the Yes Network, you know, Yankee Entertainment System Network, I expect that. This is FS1. You're just supposed to call the game for the game itself, not for the God, please keep New York in the playoffs. It helps our ratings huge. That's what they do, and I'm just done with that kind of stuff, Kush.
No, and I get you. I've learned to not let it bother me as much because I quite frankly, you know, expect it. I take the other, honest to goodness, Bob, I take the other side of it, which is, you know, call me the day that somebody in a broadcast, national broadcast like that is blatantly pro-Cleveland, because I'll have bridges to nowhere to sell to you, because that ain't ever happening.
I don't even want pro-Cleveland. I don't even want pro-Cleveland. I just want call the game.
Sure. No, you know, I get that, and I don't let it bother me anymore.
Have a guy from Des Moines, Iowa, who has never rooted for any team in his life, call the game. Have somebody who doesn't have a bias, somebody who isn't necessarily interested in driving up the ratings because of by keeping New York in it, all these different things. I just want to hear a fair. I don't want to hear the well. I guess I would prefer to hear my team's call, my team's, you know, television call, because it makes me more excited. But if it is a national call, damn it, call it like it's a national game. Anyway, I'm getting far too off into that.
I'll get us off this subject, Bob. Hey, guys, who've been a couple guys who had just called me called up here to the station. Next time, decide to go on with Bob when you're laughing about the Yankees and poor salty Bob. Why don't you give us a call and stay on the line 866-240-1065.
I'm salty. Yeah, I'm salty. I'm pissed. I'm disappointed. I'm everything that you would be if something like this did just happen to you. If you're a Tigers fan and the Tigers are losing a playoff series, a World Series, and you have seen and had enough experience with that to know what I'm talking about. But especially when you've done it in record fashion, yeah, the way they did last year with a 3-1 series lead blown, three chances to close it out, and then a 2-0 series lead with three chances to close it out in back-to-back years.
Here, I'll even go to a different subject on this same type of topic, too. Something that's been just eating at my craw today.
Okay, don't go too far away, because I do want to come back to the Kluber thing.
Sure, sure.
You said in the first hour that surprised me.
All day long, another thing I've been hearing is, oh, this is why the Indians needed to have like a five-game losing streak after their record. I mean, look, baloney. They were the hottest team in baseball. I thought being hot at the end, you know, matters. And, of course, the counters. Well, you know, the Dodgers, they were so good. Then they had their swoon at the end of August into September. And now, look, they swept the Diamondbacks. Everything. You got to lose some after. Baloney. Just that is utter baloney. And I want to nip that in the bud right now.
Well, I wouldn't have wanted them to go into the playoffs on a 33-game winning streak. Okay? I will say that. You have to figure out how to bounce back from a game in which you don't shake hands at the end for the first time in a long time. I wouldn't have liked that. I do think you needed a loss or two mixed in. But to say a five-game losing streak, and I have heard the same thing, Jim, from a lot of people who have said that.
Honestly, that's the thing that's been annoying me more than anything on this today.
Yeah, that's just dumb. Now, you do need to know how to come back from a loss, because when you get used to the magic of a winning streak, and it really is kind of magical when you're talking about, you know, late inning heroics that turn L's into W's that keep a streak going and that kind of thing, you feel like it's owed to you every game, and there's no worries, it's going to happen, and then when it doesn't, how do you respond? And you know you're not going to just go ahead and sweep every playoff series, so how are you going to respond? For a game in which the other team is shaking hands and you're the one kind of cleaning out the dugout in silence, you do need that, but not a five-game losing streak. I certainly think you need to remind yourself that baseball is a game of wins and losses. It is not a game that you can just do 22-game winning streaks. There's a reason why that has never been done in the American League, and has only been done by one team and to a larger extent since 1916. Okay, there's a reason. You're supposed to have losses in baseball, and part of baseball is overcoming them. So the point that people are making about that, I get, but to say they needed a losing streak or something stupid like that, no, I disagree. And don't compare what happened to the Dodgers. Let me tell you this. I promise you that Dave Roberts and Clayton Kershaw and all the players and Bellinger, all of the Dodgers who just swept the Diamondbacks in the NLDS, ask them right now if they would like to have won all of those games in the, what was it, 11 games that they lost and like 16
out of 18? It was 15 out of 16 and 11 in a row.
Thank you. Go ahead and ask them right now, even after sweeping, if they liked that. If they thought that was good to have a swoon and then you find a way to get out of it and come back. No, nobody ever wants that. I don't care what they tell you and what it looks like after the fact. During it and even after it, nobody wants that. They would rather say, you know what, when we had our swoon, I would prefer it had been 8-7 as opposed to losing 15 out of 16. I'd rather have that be 8-7 and say, man, what happened to us? We were on a record pace, and now we slipped a 500 ball. I promise you they would rather have that than what they had. So don't give me any of that nonsense about you needed a losing streak or any kind of crap like that. Now,
yeah, because again, it defeats the purpose of, I thought you were the hottest. You want to be the hot team going into October. Wouldn't the Indians, since that streak began, wouldn't that be the definition of being hot? I mean,
yeah, well, you absolutely, of course. And you know, this is the point here is you are supposed to be playing your best baseball going in. But again, you do also have to realize, all right, how do you come back from the adversity that when, hey, we didn't get the timely hit this time, we lost. We didn't get that big strikeout that we needed and we lost. How do you come back from that? There is something to that because baseball is a game of wins and losses. It is obviously the game in which you play the most games, or I'm sorry, the sport in which you play the most games, you know, compared to all of the sports.
Right, yeah.
And that means you have the most losses. You're a championship team that wins 100 games, loses 62 freaking times.
Yep.
You have to know how to lose. So I understand the point about not wanting to go in, you know, undefeated in the last month or something silly. But to say you needed a swoon or a losing streak is just garbage.
You know, the only other thing that's keeping me from just really honestly losing it today on this whole subject is, and I'm sure something we'll have plenty of weeks and months ahead to talk more about, is that almost all of this team in its entirety, a couple exceptions, are back next year, and the AL Central suddenly really, really, really stinks. So there will be a redemption shot next October.
Oh, there's no doubt. No question about it. That's the one thing that you take away from it. But, Jim, I don't want to get too far away from what you said in the first hour. When I brought up, you know, the timely hitting or the lack of timely hitting, et cetera, et cetera. And you kind of just dismissed most of that and said Kluber. You just kind of put it all on Kluber's two starts. You didn't allow for Brantley stinking. You didn't really speak to Encarnacion's absence. And then, of course, he stunk last night when he did come back. The way Ramirez stunk the whole playoff series. Lindor did the whole playoff series with the exception of the Grand Slam. You didn't get much from Kipnis either. And then, of course, we talked about the kicking the ball all over the field with Urshela with two errors and Salazar with an error. You put it all on Kluber. Why do you not think that it was a total team collapse and that it all comes down to Kluber? They weren't scoring. Look at what Carrasco did. Carrasco didn't do a Kluber. He went out and threw a gem for six innings and didn't get a run of support. Gave up one mistake. Actually, it was Miller.
Yeah, it was Miller. It was shutout ball for Carrasco.
But the run is charged. No, it wasn't. The run is charged to Miller.
Right? Yeah, it had to be. He's the one who gave up the homer.
That's right. But anyway, the point is, the offense wasn't there the whole time, and you're kind of putting it on just the ace, the guy who started games 2 and 5. And I wanted to find out why that was.
Well, in that case, if that's how you took it,
that's how it sounded.
Then I apologize for making it sound like that. More of me is stunned by the fact that here we are after game 5, and you had two Corey Kluber clunkers in a row. We had a wild stat or something like that just the other day where I had found out that the last time Kluber had given up 6 runs like he did in game 2 was in 2013. I'm more stunned by that development than any of the others, as bad as they are, the kicking the ball around, the nobody showing up at the plate, Ramirez, Lindor, etc. I'm most stunned. You know, by that, we have been saying for basically 48 hours here, Bob, that, you know, you have Kluber on the mound. What did I say? It's not like it's Charles Nagy in 1999 right. Going out there and there's no Pedro coming out there.
The matter is, you didn't even, strange as it sounds, you didn't even need Kluber to win this series because you won game 1 with Bauer.
Yeah.
You should have won game 3 because Carrasco was so terrific. And you could have won. You did win the Kluber start. I'm sorry, despite his clunker,
yeah.
You overcame it in 13. So this thing should have been over without needing Corey Kluber a second time and without getting a great start from him the first time. So, as strange as it is, even if your ace wanted to go out there and throw out a clunker or two, there were 3 other opportunities to win that series. And you did one of them with one of the clunkers, and you got great starts from Carrasco and Bauer around that. You know, so to me, it's more of it is on the offense not taking care of business, not getting the timely hits, not doing the clutch things they did all season long than it was Kluber.
Oh, I still think
you could have survived Kluber without it because you got the great start from Bauer and Carrasco.
Oh, and at the end of the day, that is the biggest culprit. The fact that after the back and forth crazy game 2, this team completely forgot how to hit. You could see them all up there, especially Jose Ramirez, I think, more than anybody, just pressing. You know, in a way that you hadn't seen all season. I mean, that's still the primary, I think, blame from the innings. I'm more shocked than anything that Kluber didn't rebound. Yeah, the only runs he gave up were the 2 homers, and he struck out 6. But, again, as I point out in the that I played in the montage of Terry Francona, even he was saying, it wasn't crisp. His pitches were flat. Yeah.
Just the 2 pitches that were hammered. That's the thing. I mean, you know, he made 2 bad pitches. When you strike out 6, you're not flat every bat, obviously. Every batter, you're doing pretty damn well.
Yeah.
The 2 that were hit were flat. The 2 that only Gregorius, or for crying out loud, why am I forgetting how to say his name now?
No, you said it right, Gregorius.
Yeah, Gregorius. I don't know why that's hard for me suddenly. But the 2 that he hit, I mean, were the only 2 mistakes that he made, for crying out loud. So I still can't. I wouldn't even say that it was in and of itself a clunker the second time around. I do understand lifting him when he did, you know, with the 4 1/3, I think, is what he went in. But it's not like he didn't have his stuff, and it's not like he was flat for, you know, he was getting banged around. It was just 2 swings by the same guy that obviously, you know, found their way out of the park. So there were so many things that were wrong with that series other than Corey Kluber. I wanted to clarify that. By the way, including the roster, because I still will stand by what I said before. and I said it going into the series, that Tito Francona would prove me wrong, clearly, because he knows more than I do. But I now go back and I say, I didn't like the addition of Salazar to that roster. I didn't really like Brantley being on that roster, especially if he was going to play anything more than pinch hitting. I didn't like Kipnis in center. I feel like Austin Jackson would have caught off a run there.
I'll strangely throw you another one. I believe it was in the fourth game. Clevenger was one of the guys out of the bullpen. You know, he gave up a couple runs. Right. I suddenly, after hindsight, 20-20, wonder if Dan Otero would have been better in that situation.
Who would have been?
Maybe a Dan Otero would have been better in that situation.
That's what I said. And I think also that Clevenger would have been better as a starter because he's not used to coming out of the pen. He took two starters, Salazar and Clevenger, and put them in the pen in positions that they're not really familiar with. Like I said, then he puts Kipnis in center, and I know he played there a little bit toward the end of the season, but not enough to replace Austin Jackson there.
Let's hope that doesn't have to happen again.
And the defensive wizard that is Urshela with the injuries, obviously, was no better than Ramirez would have been.
Yeah.
You could have had Kipnis back at second, Ramirez at third, Austin in second, where they were for most of the winning season that they had. And I feel like Terry Francona, who's called the future Hall of Fame manager, et cetera, and I get that he is, I think he outmanaged himself. I think he overmanaged, overthought it, made a lot of really, you know, decisions that if they had won would be, oh, my God, look at the strategery that that guy was able to formulate.
Yeah.
And instead, I think they came back.
You know, twistedly, and few will think about this, Bob, especially when you're talking about an injury. Yeah. Most would obviously refer to Encarnacion, him not being there for the two games in New York. There was a blatant hole in that. But as it turns out, the biggest injury was Bradley Zimmer. Because then all the shifting of players at Kipnis and center, et cetera, and so on, that would have never happened.
Great point. It's a very good point. You kind of forget about that real quick. Hey, Eric in Toledo wants to make fun of me for ripping the broadcaster, so let's bring him on. Eric, you're on the air. But go right ahead, buddy.
Hey, guys, I think you're completely right. No matter what.
I thought you were going to yell at me. You think we're right?
No. Okay. No matter what happens, I'm not one of those jerks that makes fun of you guys. No matter what happens, if it's a Cleveland team versus whoever, they will always slant their broadcast against everyone else.
Why do you think that is?
Because we're a small market. It's Cleveland. Think about this. They called it the mistake on the lake for how long?
Yeah, well, it was. It was for a long time.
The river set itself on fire. It was that polluted at one point. But it's not New York.
Eric, that's what I was getting at. To me, I'm not saying this from a, hey, my team is getting crapped upon and my home city is getting crapped upon. To me, it wasn't like anti-Cleveland as much as it was just pro-New York. That they would have done the same thing had that been New York against Detroit. They would have done the same thing if it was New York against, Oakland. I don't care. It's just pro-Yankee stuff that bothers me more than really it being anti-Indians.
It's the same thing. We all remember the World Series. How much Joe Buck? Everyone hated Joe Buck because he slanted his calls for the Cubs.
Right. And I explained that one away, again, not being necessarily anti-Indian or Cleveland, but it's just that this is the lovable losers. These are the Northsiders, 1908, Goats, Bartman, all that stuff, and they loved the story. That's why I thought they propped up Chicago so much. But this one isn't like a lovable loser story. This is the New York Yankees' biggest media market, and they're going to kiss their rear ends.
Team in baseball, the Yankees!
Hey, there you go. Eric, thanks, brother. Appreciate the call. We got to go, though. That music is playing. That means I got to stop talking. But before I do, a reminder. If you are up for Haunted Hydro in this Halloween season, there's a special deal only going on today for ticket listeners. What does that mean? It means you can text and get big savings on a Haunted Hydro ticket. Right now, text to the number 64636, the word Hydro, all in lowercase letters, H-Y-D-R-O. Text that to 64636 to get a $13 ticket to the Haunted Hydro Haunted House and add an escape room ticket if you like for only $2. Only for ticket listeners and only today. So do it now. Hydro to 64636. Drive time's coming up next. Cushland in for Miller. Stay where you are. We'll see you tomorrow.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.